And then she asked whether you would release the transcripts of your Goldman Sachs speeches, and then added, don't you think the voting public has a right to know what was said? But let's make that bigger. Are you willing to release the transcripts of all your paid speeches? We do know through reporting that there were transcription services for all of those paid speeches. In full disclosure, would you release all of them?
I will look into it. I don't know the status, but I will certainly look into it.
I think in a different election year, Lincoln Chafee might have done a little bit better. I really think that in a different election year, that Martin O'Malley certainly would have done better. He made it all the way to Iowa. He dropped out the night of Iowa. What we've learned from the election this year is that all the old rules don't apply. All of the things that should have gotten Donald Trump booted out of the election and furiously booted out of the election didn't happen this year. When he called, when he said that John McCain wasn't a hero because he got captured, that should have gotten him kicked out. When he said Mexicans, although some of them I'm sure they're good that are coming here, are rapists, that should have gotten him kicked out. Bernie Sanders shouldn't even be competitive with Hillary Clinton. Allow me. There is a problem with the bankers right now. Her association with the bankers. Now, there are a lot of folks who are fans of Secretary Clinton. I count myself among them. And I have always seen her as a pretty good progressive. She's gotten more progressive over the years. But hey, everybody's allowed to change their mind. I remember during the 2004 election when they kept going after John Kerry. And they said, John Kerry is inconsistent. You know, he's a flip-flopper, da-da-da. Well, it's okay for you to change your mind on issues. It's okay for you to evolve on issues. That shouldn't be seen as a question of character, or it shouldn't be seen as a lack in judgment. Hillary Clinton has become more progressive over the years, but during that time, she has also become very cozy with the Washington system. She's become very cozy with Wall Street and bankers. And in her defense, she did represent New York. That is where Wall Street is at. But you're now running for an election during a year when all of the old rules don't apply.
Can you really reform Wall Street when they are spending millions and millions of dollars on campaign contributions and when they are providing speaker fees to individuals? So it's easy to say, well, I'm going to do this and do that. But I have doubts when people receive huge amounts of money from Wall Street. I am very proud. I do not have a super PAC. I do not want Wall Street's money. I'll rely on the middle class and working families for my campaign contributions.
I won't tell you how much money I make, but I am easily in the middle class. I myself clear less than 50 grand a year. Between my wife and I, we clear more than that, but we are very comfortably middle class. And it takes me a year to make what I make, which, remember, is just under 50 grand a year. She gave three speeches and collected a little bit over $600,000 for those three speeches. Now, unless those speeches were 5 years long, I don't know what she got that much money for. The folks sitting in, the bankers sitting in listening to her speeches, I'm fairly certain did not walk away feeling $200,000, $300,000, $500,000, or $600,000 better than they did before she showed up. And did she show up and give them some sort of secrets that they didn't know? I mean, something they didn't know about before she began talking with them? Or did she sit down with these guys, or in this case, stand before them and say to them, whatever you want, that's what you're going to get. And I, as president, will deliver it to you. Now, I know it's cynical and a little bit mean of me to see it that way, but what did she say that is worth that amount of money? And this is why it matters. The bankers crashed our economy, absolutely obliterated our economy. Millions of people suffered for it for damn near a decade because of it. People lost their homes, people lost their jobs, people lost their retirement. They lost a ton of money, and nobody went to jail for it. They collected all of the profits that they made from crashing the economy and then left us with nothing. We're just now coming out of it. And The bankers are saying that they would like to have a little bit more power, please. They would like to have a little bit more influence, please. And they realize that they're going to have to buy Democrats and Republicans if they want control of Washington, D.C. So who comes along in this election? Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders to just muck everything up, to overturn the apple cart. I don't think that Senator Clinton is evil. And I don't think that Senator Clinton wants to serve the bankers. I know she's a progressive, and I've seen her get more progressive over the years. But I think she was learning to operate inside of a broken system. And says, yes, inside of a broken system, you have to have super PACs. Inside of a broken system, you have to take money from bankers. Inside of a broken system, you have to get cozy with Wall Street. Inside of a broken system, sometimes you have to do things that in any other instance might show a lack of judgment. And for Senator Clinton to say, it didn't change any of my votes. It didn't influence me. You can't point out anything where I've changed my mind because I got some money. Oh, but Senator Clinton, we can. This is the first part of an interview where Elizabeth Warren sat down with a journalist and talked about the difference between First Lady Clinton and Senator Clinton.
I had written an op-ed about a piece of pending bankruptcy legislation. The credit card companies have been pushing to try to tighten the bankruptcy laws, sort of like locking the doors to the hospitals and then claiming nobody's sick in America. So they were trying to get the bankruptcy laws constricted so that fewer families could get in. Why? Because you can make more money if those families don't go into bankruptcy if you're a credit lender. Mrs. Clinton evidently saw
the First Lady.
She was then First Lady. This is in the 1990s, late 1990s. Mrs. Clinton saw the piece, and I got a call from the White House. And they said Mrs. Clinton was going to be in town to give a speech in Boston, and would I come and meet with her? I said, sure. And so I put together all my files. I show up at the appointed place. After she's finished her speech, we're ushered into a tiny little room somewhere in the bowels of this hotel. And just the two of us. They close the door. Mrs. Clinton sits down. We have hamburgers and French fries.
And you tutor her.
And she says, tell me about bankruptcy. And I got to tell you, I never had a smarter student. Quick, right to the heart of it. I go over the law. It's a complex law. Went over the economics, showed her the graphs, showed her the charts, and she got it. Within 20 minutes, she could play where the rest of it would come. Well, then that will mean this part's happened. That will mean this has happened. I said, yes, that's right. And at the end of the conversation, Mrs. Clinton stood up. She said, let's get our picture taken, which we did. And she said, Professor Warren, we've got to stop that awful bill, referring to this bankruptcy bill that's sponsored by the credit card companies. And when Mrs. Clinton came back with a little better understanding of how it all worked, they reversed course, and they reversed course fast. And indeed, the proof is in the pudding. The last bill that came before President Clinton was that bankruptcy bill that was passed by the House and the Senate in 2000, and he vetoed it. And in her autobiography, Mrs. Clinton took credit for that veto, and she rightly should. She turned around a whole administration on the subject of bankruptcy. One of the first bills that came up after she was Senator Clinton was the bankruptcy bill. This is a bill that's like a vampire. It will not die, right? There's a lot of money behind it.
And the bill her husband had vetoed.
Her husband had vetoed it very much at her urging.
And?
She voted in favor of it.
Why?
As Senator Clinton, the pressures are very different. It's a well-financed industry. You know, a lot of people don't realize that the industry that gave the most money to Washington over the past few years was not the oil industry, was not pharmaceuticals, it was consumer credit products.
And it's not that those industries, oil and pharmaceuticals, it's not as though those industries don't give a ton of money to Congress. They do. But the biggest amount of money, and President Obama is guilty of this as well. He took a lot of Wall Street money for his 2008 campaign. Now, he hasn't been a friend to Wall Street necessarily, but I believe that it is one of the biggest factors in why he did not go after Wall Street and why nobody none of the Wall Street bankers, where it can be proved beyond the shadow of a doubt that they caused the crash that led to a lot of families breaking up, people losing their jobs, suicides. I believe that the reason our current president didn't go after them was because he got a ton of money from them. So although he did not snuggle up to them, although he did not cozy up to them and share beers with them and hang out with them on the weekends, he did not go after them, and it is within his authority, within his Justice Department, to do so. And he didn't. And why? Money. The influence of money ruins everything.
What does this mean, though, to these people, these millions of people out there whom the politicians cavort in front of as favoring the middle class and then are beholden to the powerful interests that undermine the middle class? What does it say about politics today?
You know, this is the scary part about democracy today. We're talking again about the impact of money. The credit industry on this bankruptcy bill has spent tens of millions of dollars lobbying, and as their profits grow, they just throw more into lobbying for how they can get laws that will make it easier and easier and easier to drain money out of the pockets of middle-class families.
When Bernie Sanders entered the race, he was dismissed immediately. He was called a fringe candidate. He will not have the organization. He will not be able to raise money. He is a socialist. He's a democratic socialist, but that's not what's being pointed out. The fact that the socialist is in his party's name. By the way, socialist is in my party's name. I, too, am a democratic socialist and have associated for a while. When he entered the race, they said there is no way he's going to be able to gain any ground. And then he built a ground game early. I hosted a rally at my home back in August of last year. Right, so we are now in February of 2016. So 6 months ago, I held a rally in my backyard where I got almost 100 people into my backyard. I stood up, I gave a speech, we all sat around, we talked to each other, some of us became friends, some of us just became Facebook friends, which is still just as good. But everybody, there was a part of the reason we got together was because Senator Sanders says that he was going to give a speech. And as I being a host of the party, I got to see the speech or the proposed text of the speech beforehand. So I knew what he was going to say. And there was a part in his speech where he was going to say, pick up your phone and text the word work to, I forget what the 5-digit number was. But knowing that that was going to be coming up in the speech, I, as a good host, decided to get some gigantic poster board and put on the poster board, text the word work to this number. And I made a couple of those, and my wife and I held those up when that part of the speech came up. And I'm not kidding. There wasn't a single person in my backyard that did not whip out their phone and automatically began doing that. 100% of the people they were all looking forward. They were watching the speech. And then when he said that, 100% of them whipped out their phones and all texted. And then I heard the chimes coming in. And that was the Sanders campaign getting back to them saying, you are now confirmed. That long ago, we got this many people involved. And then there were several more opportunities to hold rallies after that. I was unable to hold another one, scheduling conflicts and any and all the rest. But for that long, the Sanders campaign has been building this great ground game. And now he's become a threat to Senator Clinton. There were 5 people that started in the race. Martin O'Malley, Link Chafee, Jim Webb, Hillary Clinton, and Bernie Sanders. And now we're only down to Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. How in the hell did that happen with a fringe candidate, with a guy who calls himself a socialist? Well, because what he's saying is not outside the mainstream. What he's saying is what a lot of even Republicans want to hear. And now that he's being seen as a threat to the Clinton campaign, now that he is easily outraising them with respect to the official campaign numbers, not with a super PAC. Bernie doesn't have a super PAC. Hillary does. So her super PAC is still raising tons of money for her, but she doesn't get to count that in her coffers. And now the Sanders campaign is outraising her. Back during the 2008 campaign, as a part of the way to end corruption begin ending corruption in our elections, then candidate Obama said that he did not want lobbyists to be able to have influence in the elections. He banned lobbyist money He said, we should ban lobbyist money. And the DNC responded. They said, yes, we're going to ban lobbyist money. You know, nope, well, you're not going to buy our elections. You know, so this would be money that goes into the official election coffers, not the super PAC coffers. This year, seeing Bernie Sanders in their rearview mirror, seeing people switching from Hillary to Bernie, seeing how crazy people are going for this 74-year-old Jewish socialist. The DNC, which has had their thumb on the scale for Hillary Clinton the whole time. This is why they decided to hide all of the Democratic debates, because they did not want Sanders to get a lot of exposure. There has been a virtual media blackout on Sanders up to this point. He's only been an underground phenomena. You got to be a policy wonk. You got to be a civics wonk. You got to be a politics geek in order to know who Senator Sanders is. And even with the DNC trying to keep people away from Bernie Sanders, even with hiding the debates, it wasn't enough. And now Sanders has become a threat to the Clinton campaign. And it's looking like 2008 is playing out all over again. So the DNC trying to further put their thumb on the scale for Senator Clinton. The DNC has decided to allow that dirty money to come back in the election. That thing that they put in place for then candidate Obama, they have decided to bring back because they're pretty sure. No. They're 100% sure, and they won't say this. They're 100% sure that that money is going to go to Senator Clinton's campaign. So now they're essentially admitting that they need that dirty money. And that is why money is a problem. That is why money is an outsized influence. And that's why we need to find a way to get money out of the election. And that is why Wall Street has become such a big deal in this election. Just the very conscious idea, just people recognizing that it's there and the kind of influence it has. And this is where Bernie is banging back against Wall Street.
CEOs of large multinationals may like Hillary. They ain't going to like me. And Wall Street is going to like me even less. And the reason for that is we've got to deal with the elephant in the room, which is the greed, recklessness, and illegal behavior on Wall Street. When you have six financial institutions in this country that issue 2/3 of the credit cards and 1/3 of the mortgages, when 3 out of 4 of them are larger today than when we bail them out because they are too big to fail. We've got to reestablish Glass-Steagall. We have got to break the large financial institutions up. So I don't think, having said that, I don't think I'm going to get a whole lot of campaign contributions from Wall Street. I don't have a super PAC. I don't want campaign contributions from corporate America.
And I will point out, as I said before, Secretary Clinton is just operating inside of a broken system. Yes, yes, she is. But Bernie has found a way to operate inside the same system without being bought and without being corrupted. Now, does this mean that if we got a president, Hillary Clinton, does this mean that they would have outsized influence again? I don't think so. And I don't think so because as the campaign has gone on, she has worked pretty hard to start sounding more and more like Bernie Sanders. So rather than somebody who coddles Wall Street, I think she would do the same thing that President Obama has done. She wouldn't coddle them necessarily, but she would not go after them.
Greed, fraud, dishonesty, and arrogance. These are some of the words that best describe the reality of Wall Street today.
Greed is good was the mantra that was fed to us during the Reagan years. Greed is good. Get as much as you can. And then you in the lower and middle class, you should want them to get as much as they can. You know why? Because trickle down. It will eventually trickle down to you. If you let them get as much as they want. And by the way, enough is never enough. There is never enough money. You have never accumulated enough properties. You can never own enough people. Hoarding. You can never hoard enough money. Greed is good. And it's taken 30 years, but we're finally seeing that very poisonous idea go away.
So to those on Wall Street who may be listening
and they
to
are.
My remarks, and I'm sure there are many of them. Let me be very clear. Greed is not good. In fact, the greed of Wall Street and corporate America is destroying the very fabric of our nation.
Hillary still hasn't come out and spoken against the poisonous influence of Wall Street. By the way, one of the best ideas we can have is what is called a transaction tax. I will tell you what it is. I will give you the left-wing point of view, and then I will give you the right-wing point of view. So right now, most of the folks that make their money on Wall Street, and I've discussed this before, but it bears repeating, they make their money through what is called high-frequency trading, and it's done with computers. They just – and they have computer algorithms that they've designed that will trade thousands or tens of thousands of stocks in a minute. Buy it at one price, let a penny or two get onto that price, and then sell it. So they're making teeny, teeny, tiny bits of, you know, pennies here, pennies there. But when you're having thousands of transactions a minute at the end of each day, you've made money. You may have lost a little, but collectively, in aggregate, you're in the surplus for sure. You've made a lot of money. And these guys that are involved in high frequency trading, they're not creating anything. They're not adding anything. They're not creating jobs. They're not creating consumer products. They're not adding to the economy. All they're doing is skimming a little bit off the top and then taking that money and just living high on it. And it's not because of their hard work. They've just found a way to game the system. So a transaction tax, which means there would be a small tax put on every single transaction. This would do two things. One, it would discourage high frequency trading because that 1 or 2 cents that they made might now cost them 5 cents. So then they would be in the negative. If you want to buy and sell stocks, that's fine. But you should buy and sell them like a regular person does and hold on to them, and they should be investments. You shouldn't be doing this high-frequency trading, which just allows you to skim a little bit of money off the top. I also had this idea a while ago because commodities trading. A lot of folks will buy commodities just to drive up the price of them, and then, you know, once the price is driven up, then they cash them out, and they get their money for them. And I remember when oil hit $150 a barrel, which is crazy because it's about $27 a barrel right now. But it hit $150 a barrel just because of the gaming that was going on Wall Street. We had two wars that was using a lot of petroleum. Americans' cars, a lot of petroleum. Planes, a lot of petroleum was being used. And they artificially gamed the system, got the price up to $150 a barrel. Gasoline in some places went over $5. In most places, it was above $4. And this was during the George W. Bush administration. I had an idea back then that if you're going to buy and sell commodities, you should have a way to take delivery of that commodity. Which is to say, if you buy 100,000 pork bellies, you should have a place to store 100,000 pork bellies. If you decide to buy 10,000 barrels of oil, you better have a place to store 10,000 barrels of oil. Otherwise, you don't get to buy it. Now, I understand that may not work. Okay. But I thought it was pretty good. Okay, so back to the transaction tax. So the left wing says, hey, this transaction tax would, one, get Wall Street under control, and two, it would make some money that we could then put into the coffers. We don't have to raise taxes. We can just take it from these guys, right? Now here comes the right wing argument. You know who this is going to hit? This Wall Street transaction tax. And by the way, Wall Street owns the Republican Party, flat out. There's no two ways about it. They're flat out owned. You know who this is going to hurt? This is going to hurt consumers. This is going to hurt you with a 401k. This is going to hurt you, the regular guy who buys and sells stocks, which I don't think a lot of folks, it doesn't matter. It's going to hurt you. It's not going to hurt Wall Street because they got tons of money. It's going to hurt you. Now remember, they have to personalize this. They have to say that it's going to hurt you in the middle class and not them up there. They work for them. They do not work for you. This is going to hurt you. So you, because there's lots more of you and I, middle class people. There's tons more of us. So if you say it's going to hurt Wall Street, what is that? compared to the country, that's a handful of people. But if they say it's going to hurt you in the middle class, and you don't do your homework to figure out what high-frequency trading is or how the system has been gamed, then you might believe this. So that's the right-wing argument. But it's a lie. It's wrong. When you think of stock buying, everybody thinks you buy some stocks, you sell some stocks. You hold them, you sell, you know, buy low, sell high, all that stuff. But that's not what they're doing. They're using computers and high-frequency trading to game the system. And all it's doing is stealing from the rest of us.
And here is a New Year's resolution that I will keep if elected president. And that is, if Wall Street does not end its greed, we will end it for them.
And that is exactly how we will end it for them. We will end it by putting in a transaction tax on that type of high-frequency trading. So, on to another issue, healthcare.
Every major country on earth, whether it's the UK, whether it's France, whether it's Canada, has managed to provide healthcare to all people as a right. And they are spending significantly less per capita on healthcare than we are. So I do not accept the belief that the United States of America can't do that. I do not accept the belief that the United States of America and our government can't stand up to the ripoffs of the pharmaceutical industry, which charge us by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs.
By far and away, the biggest and dumbest argument against the idea of single-payer healthcare is that we are not Europe. It can't happen here. Here we are different. Here's how we are not different. We too have bodies. We too have men and women. We too have the young and the old. We too get illnesses. We too have a society. So what does that mean? When something is socialized, okay, and we're not talking about the means of owning the means of production here, all this would do is shift the way that we pay for it. The hospitals would still be owned by private industries, okay, or not-for-profits. And the way they would be paid for would come out of one pot, one insurance plan. There would be other insurance plans if you wanted to have one of the Cadillac plans. That's fine. You wanted to have something where you had, you know, somebody brought highfalutin meals into your room and you got a $10,000 a night hospital bed. Fine. You can still have separate insurance for that. But for your primary, it would only come out of one pot. And yes, that pot would be administered by the federal government. But the federal government can't do anything right. Is that true? Anything. And it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's business or whether it's government, it's only as good as the people that make it up. And if you say government can't do anything right, well, then guess what? You don't get to administer the plan. We will find somebody who can and will administer the plan and do a good job. The federal government is not an inherently bad thing. It's not an inherently stupid thing. But when you put people in charge of it who want it to go bad, who want it to be stupid, who want it to do dumb things, that's when it goes wrong. It's just like with a business. If you want your business to do well, you put somebody in charge of it who cares about it. Somebody who's going to care about the outcome. Somebody who maybe has experience in it. Somebody who believes in it. You don't put somebody in charge of it that says, I'm going to burn this place to the ground. What Bernie is talking about is expanding on our system. We already have a single-payer system in place. It's called Medicare. All we would have to do, and first of all, it would be an absolute shock to the system to all of a sudden add 300 million people to the system. So what we would do is we would gradually lower the age of retirement. I believe I heard Tom Hartman talk about this a little while ago, and I think it's a good idea. So you make eventually dropping the age of eligibility to zero so that you're born with it. So 60, 55, 50, on down, you know, adding five age years at a time, say every year or two. However, whatever rate is comfortable, of course, the bean counters in the Congressional Budget Office would have to figure this out. But however long it would take to comfortably implement those people into the system until you eventually get the age down to zero. So one of the worst things that Senator Clinton has done is she has said, and it's a lie, she said that Bernie wants to tear apart everything that we worked for with Obamacare and start all over. It's not true. It's not true. He wants to take the single-payer system that we already have, and he wants to expand on it, eventually raising the age or lowering the age of eligibility to zero and getting everybody inside that system. And Secretary Clinton has said it's not going to happen.
Health emergencies can't wait for us to have some theoretical debate about some better idea that will never, ever come to pass.
And there you go. She said it. It is never, ever going to come to pass. How effing dare you, Bernie Sanders? How dare you? Single piece never going to happen. Grr! How dare you go after President Obama's plan? Hey, good for Obamacare. Glad that we have it. Glad that it's there. But we can do better. Because even with that, we still have somewhere around 10% of people who have no insurance. And then there are folks like myself that do have insurance, but it still isn't that great because it's run by private for-profit companies that don't care and are really only in it for the money. So somebody must have said something to Senator Clinton, because after she won Iowa, she decided to all of a sudden come out in favor of the single-payer system.
I know what we are capable of doing. I know we can create more good-paying jobs and raise incomes for hardworking Americans again. I know that we can finish the job of universal health care coverage for every single man, woman, and child.
That blew my mind to hear that, because it wasn't but a few days ago that I just heard her say, get off of it, Bernie and Bernie supporters. It is never going to freaking happen. But if she's going to survive in this race, she needs to realize you can't go around telling us, no, we can't. A part of the message that President Obama ran on was, yes, we can. Will.i.am even put out a song about, yes, we can. Because people like hope. People like believing that we can do big things. At the time that we announced that we wanted to go to the moon, none, and this has been pointed out, none of the technology to go to the moon existed. And I believe within 11 or 12 years, we went to the freaking moon. We can do anything that we put our minds to. And we as Americans don't like being told that we can't do it. There was a time, and I believed that we would never, ever, ever see marriage equality come to pass, ever. Especially with five conservatives on the Supreme Court. Because I knew that there would eventually be a challenge in the Supreme Court. And there was. And the folks on the far right on the Supreme Court, some of them got really nasty about this particular issue, but we got it. And I remember the day that we got it. I was celebrating. I myself am not gay. I don't have a lot of gay friends. I have a few. But I was so happy, because this idea that this could never happen, never happen, most certainly not happen in my lifetime, just happened. And I'm alive, and I'm here to see it, and it's absolutely effing amazing. And the way that we got there was through hard work, of the hard work of folks who always believed, who always held on to that seemingly impossible idea, and worked very, very hard towards that objective. Never ever said that it can't happen. Never ever ever defended DOMA. Never said that, you're gay, so you don't get the same rights as everyone else. We don't believe that. Senator Sanders is one of the people that said we should have that, and said it decades ago. Then, and this is one of the other issues that has come up in this election, there was a time, and it wasn't that long ago, where Secretary Clinton did not believe in this idea, and she had all of the right-wing talking points at hand when she decided to announce it as Senator Clinton.
I believe that marriage is not just a bond, but a sacred bond between a man and a woman. I have had occasion in my life to defend marriage, to stand up for marriage, to believe in the hard work and challenge of marriage. So I take umbrage at anyone who might suggest that those of us who worry about amending the Constitution are less committed to the sanctity of marriage or to the fundamental bedrock principle that it exists between a man and a woman going back into the mists of history as one of the founding foundational institutions of history and humanity and civilization, and that its primary principal role during those millennia has been the raising and socializing of children for the society into which they are to become adults.
The raising of history, going all the way back to the beginning of human history. This is just the way that it has always been. I am here to defend marriage, which is not a defense of marriage. I believe that letting loving couples, be they gay or straight, I believe allowing them to get married, if you really believe in families, if you really believe in marriage, then let them get married. And then there were folks who had been together 20, 30, 40, 50 years. They had men, two guys, two gals, been together 50 years. After being together 50 years, finally got married. Think about that. And you think about how quickly, I know Hollywood marriages and divorces aren't the best example, but hey, because they're straight, they get to get married and divorced as many times as they want, and nobody even bats an eyelash. Nobody calls that a threat to marriage. But these two men that have been together for 50 years, they're going to destroy marriage. Are you sure? They're using walkers now, okay? But even in that tender age, they are still as in love as they have always been. And they went out there on their walkers and their, you know, their little suits or whatever they decided to wear. And they got married, you know, and they kissed, and it was, you know, they could barely. But the love was still very much there in their eyes. And for someone to say, you can't get married because I don't think that your love is natural. Well, it's something that was never said by Senator Sanders. Now, it was said by Secretary Clinton, but she has since come out in favor of it and says, hey, I was wrong. I was wrong back then, and I'm allowed to change, and I have changed. Because she realizes that she cannot win with that kind of position. I say this not to bag on Secretary Clinton. I say this not to be mean. I say this not to slight her. But I say this because I want to point out how so many of us have come to Senator Sanders during this election year. Now, a lot of the hate that has been leveled against Secretary Clinton is not her fault. A lot of the vitriol, a lot of the sexism that has been leveled against her, folks that say she can't be president because she's a woman, or that she should be president because she's a woman, I think both are equally bad, and I don't think either one of them does any justice for her. But the hate that has been leveled against her over all these years, I don't believe that a lot of it is her fault. She is the victim of a large degree of misogyny. She was a first lady. She was a senator. She was Secretary Clinton. You know, she worked for the Children's Defense Fund. She's done all this work, and she's been in the crosshairs of the right wing for a long time. So they have built up a lot of things over time to attack her with. So a lot of the hate that has been leveled against her is not her fault, but she has been very much on the receiving end of it. And so I want to take this moment to defend her. She was on with Rachel Maddow recently. Rachel Maddow asked, how about the folks that say that you're not trustworthy? You know, that they believe that you are lying a lot. What of these folks? Perhaps it's not true, but what of them? And Secretary Clinton pointed out right away, she goes, although I'm not happy to hear this, and you have to know that, there is a reason why this is a thing.
You are really reacting to, very often they don't know, but then a lot of them will say, well, Benghazi. Mm-hmm. I'll say, okay, Benghazi. You know, did you know there were 9 separate investigations, 8 of them independent, one of them clearly partisan, admittedly to try to bring me down politically, and they all reached the same conclusions. There were things we could have and should have done better, and I immediately said we would. I testified for 11 hours. I answered every question. But it's still on the TV. I still hear people talking about it. Well, I said, I can't stop them from talking about it. I can only tell you what the facts are. And I can only tell you that in the last, 36, 37 years, we've had terrorist problems in Iran, in Lebanon, in Kenya, in Tanzania, in New York, and yes, in Benghazi, none of them were ever politicized. We lost 258 Marines and embassy personnel in Beirut. The Democrats didn't stand up and go after the Secretary of State. We lost people in Kenya and Tanzania, 12 Americans, hundreds of Africans. Madeleine Albright was Secretary of State. She forthrightly asked for a report. She made it public. People didn't turn it into a partisan attack. So I have to only conclude that there is a concerted effort to try to make partisan advantage by really throwing so much at me that even if little splotches of it stick, it will cloud people's judgment of me. So that's a burden I carry. But when you stop and think, you know, the people who have supported me are not doing it because they just like me. I mean, I have the governor of Vermont supporting me. I have Pat Leahy, the senator from Vermont, supporting me. The two former governors, Madeleine Cunin and Howard Dean, supporting me. They clearly know us both, and they clearly prefer to support me. I have the senator here, the governor in New Hampshire. They know me. They trust me. They're not the kind of people who would just sign on to a campaign for some frivolous reason. I have all my friends from the Senate, Cory Booker and Tim Kaine and Kirsten Gillibrand and Debbie Stabenow and Amy Klobuchar. They were all up here in the snow because of me, and they trust me. So I can't stop the barrage of attacks, but I want your viewers and anyone else who would be interested in this to ask themselves, why does the right, and particularly the Republicans, spend so much time, money, and effort through the media, through their advertising? Because you look at the Republicans are running more ads against me than they run against each other, accusing me of being this and that, all kinds of accusations. Why? And I'll tell you why. Because they are afraid of me. They know that I will be a president who, yes, I will listen to people, I will seek common ground, but I will stand my ground, and I know how to get things done. And that's the last thing these guys ever want to see again.
She pointed out Howard Dean in that clip. And Howard Dean, yes, he used to be governor of Vermont. Yes, Howard Dean, and she also points that out because Bernie's from Vermont. Bernie's a senator from Vermont. And she points him out and says, yes, you know, and she pointed out a few other people, but Howard Dean got behind me. Now, Howard Dean also used to be the head of the DNC. Howard Dean ran in 2004 and put together what is now known as the 50 state strategy, which is something that the senator's campaign is employing. I used to be a big Howard Dean booster, but Howard Dean eventually gets out of the DNC. He doesn't run for office again, but Howard Dean is still very much around, and Howard Dean is now a lobbyist for the health insurance industry, and has come out very much against, no surprise, Bernie Sanders' plan. So even though Secretary Clinton is a good progressive, and I think that she would make a good president, it once again highlights the problem that a lot of folks have with Secretary Clinton. You're excited that this guy who is now a lobbyist for the healthcare industry has gotten behind your campaign. And so this brings us back to Bernie. He's pointed out the problem with money. He's pointed out the problem with lobbyists. He's pointed out the problem with super PACs. And for some reason, nobody can understand why so many people are so behind him in such a big way. So Iowa. He wins, or he loses Iowa by 0.2 percentage points, the just a razor-thin freaking margin. But then, when he shows up to New Hampshire the very next day and gets off the plane at 5 a.m., he is forced to give an impromptu speech because there are hundreds of people waiting at the freaking airport at 5 in the morning for him.
Believe. What time is this? That's amazing. You cannot believe that you're here at 5 o'clock in the morning. something that's wrong with you guys. I don't know. We thank you. We thank you so much. And look.
And it just gets way more raucous from there. So, he didn't win in Iowa, but then again, in my opinion, neither did Hillary Clinton. And then went on to win and win huge. This formerly fringe candidate went on to win huge in New Hampshire.
CNN makes two projections in New Hampshire. CNN projects that Donald Trump will be the winner of the New Hampshire Republican primary. We also project that Bernie Sanders will be the winner of the Democratic primary New Hampshire. There you see the winner, Donald Trump, the Republican primary winner. Bernie Sanders, we project, will be the Democratic winner. We make that projection on the basis of the exit poll information we have received. We also make that projection on the actual numbers, the actual votes that have already been tallied. All of the polls in those states, in the states, are now closed.
Senator Sanders and Donald Trump win New Hampshire. These two guys, okay, now we know how Senator Sanders slowly got into this race by building up this coalition. But if you don't remember, Donald Trump got into this race by making an announcement in a shopping mall, okay, where he had to pay hundreds of extras, $50 for 3 hours worth of work to stand there with signs and t-shirts and pretend that they were excited for him. He's got actual support now. But these two formerly fringe candidates are now the guys to beat. Because these are the guys that just won New Hampshire and came pretty damn close in Iowa, which nobody thought they would. And what do these two have in common? One, they're both talking about trade. Both of them are talking about how awful our trade deals are. And two, neither one of them can be bought. Now, to be fair, with respect to Senator Sanders, he's eventually going to have to deal with the super PAC issue. Just because he doesn't have a super PAC now doesn't mean that one won't pop up. Remember, the candidates don't start those. Outside interest groups do. And then there's the Donald. Yes, he can't be bought, but he himself is a billionaire. And don't think that he will not act largely in their interest. But let's not take away exactly what this is. This win is huge.
A huge voter turnout. And I say huge.
Now, even though it was a big voter turnout, it was actually in New Hampshire larger for the Republicans, and it was actually down a little bit in New Hampshire for the Democrats. Now, this can be explained a couple of different ways. I believe that because there still was so many people in the presidential race, in the GOP, running for the GOP ticket, that is why more people turned out. There's two people on the Democratic side now, and it's going to be a fight. It's going to be a massive fight from here on out. The fact that the DNC has now decided to start allowing lobbyist contributions, the fact that the DNC is still further trying to put their thumb on the scale for Hillary Clinton. It's about to get nasty, and it's about to get nasty real quick, and the Sanders campaign knows that.
Been criticized during this campaign for many, many things. Every single day. That's okay. That's all right. They're throwing everything at me except the kitchen sink, and I have the feeling that kitchen sink is coming pretty soon as well.
We really do have two good candidates. What can be described as an embarrassment of riches. I think either one of these folks would make a great, great president. But working inside, operating inside of that broken system for too long has handicapped Secretary Clinton. But she can come back. But the way to fight back is not dirty, not with dirty money, not with coddling the people that have bought our elections before. It's going to be interesting to find out how this turns out. But man, oh man, for a civics wonk like myself, I am glad to be alive. We'll be right back. The history of the Civil War has been hijacked largely by Southerners. And they want to believe that the Civil War was fought for reasons other than slavery. Flat out, upside down, and inside out, it was racism and it was slavery. There's no two ways about it. And no different than now, it wasn't that everybody owned slaves. It was mostly wealthy people that owned slaves. But, same as now, there is an electorate that is willing to go to bat for their wealthy masters, for the oligarchs. And there were people that fought and died in that war so that slavery could remain. Not because they themselves had slaves, but because they wanted the wealthy people to be able to have slaves. And there's a great deal of racism that is inside that too. This cut that I'm going to play for you, I've held on to for some time. And I didn't want to do a gigantic section on it. I just wanted to do a small section on the show about it. And I want to play you this clip in its entirety because this gentleman's name is Ty Sedgwick. And he lays this out in a way I've never heard it laid out before.
Was the American Civil War fought because of slavery? More than 150 years later, this remains a controversial question. Why? Because many people don't want to believe that the citizens of the southern states were willing to fight and die to preserve a morally repugnant institution. There has to be another reason, we are told. Well, there isn't. The evidence is clear and overwhelming. Slavery was, by a wide margin, the single most important cause of the Civil War for both sides. Before the presidential election of 1860, a South Carolina newspaper warned that the issue before the country was the extinction of slavery and called on all who were not prepared to surrender the institution to act. Shortly after Abraham Lincoln's victory, they did. The secession documents of every southern state made clear, crystal clear, that they were leaving the Union in order to protect their peculiar institution of slavery. A phrase that at the time meant the thing special to them. The vote to secede was 169-0 in South Carolina, 166-7 in Texas, 84-15 in Mississippi. In no southern state was the vote close. Alexander Stephens of Georgia, the Confederacy's vice president, clearly articulated the views of the South in March 1861. Our new government, he said, was founded on slavery. Its foundations are laid. Its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery, submission to the superior race, is his natural and normal condition. Yet despite the evidence, many continue to argue that other factors superseded slavery as the cause of the Civil War. Some argue that the South only wanted to protect states' rights. But this raises an obvious question. The states' rights to what? Wasn't it to maintain and spread slavery? Moreover, states' rights was not an exclusive Southern issue. All the states, North and South, sought to protect their rights. Sometimes they petitioned the federal government. Sometimes they quarreled with each other. In fact, Mississippians complained that New York had too strong a concept of states' rights because it would not allow Delta planters to bring their slaves to Manhattan. The South was preoccupied with states' rights because it was preoccupied first and foremost with retaining slavery. Some argue that the cause of the war was economic. The North was industrial and the South agrarian. And so, the two lived in such economically different societies that they could no longer stay together. Not true. In the middle of the 19th century, both North and South were agrarian societies. In fact, the North produced far more food crops than did the South. But Northern farmers had to pay their farmhands, who were free to come and go as they pleased, while Southern plantation owners exploited slaves over whom they had total control. And it wasn't just plantation owners who supported slavery. The slave society was embraced by all classes in the South. The rich had multiple motivations for wanting to maintain slavery. But so did the poor, non-slaveholding whites. The peculiar institution ensured that they did not fall to the bottom rung of the social ladder. That's why another argument that the Civil War couldn't have been about slavery because so few people owned slaves has little merit. Finally, many have argued that President Abraham Lincoln fought the war to keep the Union together not to end slavery. That was true at the outset of the war, but he did so with the clear knowledge that keeping the Union together meant either spreading slavery to all the states, an unacceptable solution, or vanquishing it altogether. In a famous campaign speech in 1858, Lincoln said, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." What was it that divided the country? It was slavery and only slavery. He continued, "I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. It will become all one thing or all the other." Lincoln's view never changed, and as the war progressed, the moral component, ending slavery, became more and more fixed in his mind. His Emancipation Proclamation in 1863 turned that into law. Slavery is the great shame of America's history. No one denies that. But it's to America's everlasting credit that it fought the most devastating war in its history in order to abolish slavery. As a soldier, I am proud that the United States Army, my army, defeated the Confederates. In its finest hour, soldiers wearing this blue uniform, almost 200,000 of them former slaves themselves, destroyed chattel slavery, freed 4 million men, women, and children from human bondage, and saved the United States of America. I'm Colonel Ty Sigely, professor and head, Department of History at the United States Military Academy, West Point, for Prager University.
And if you continue to fly the Confederate flag and say that, hey, it's only about Southern pride, you have to know that the army that defeated the Confederacy was the United States Army, was the American Army. If you want to fly a flag because you're proud of your country, that's fine. But the North and South, although it seems like we're divided, we're really not. Or at least we most certainly shouldn't be. Because we are one country. And if you continue to fly the Confederate flag and kid yourself, say to yourself, it's nothing to do with hate, it's only about heritage, that flag is used by white separatists. That flag is used by the Klan. That flag is used by Nazis. Your argument is invalid. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. You can download or stream the shows at OpenSkyArchive.com. Our official home is KiwiStation.com. Like us on Facebook at Facebook.com/TFYCPO. You can listen on the go. Just download the KiwiStation app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. The Open Sky Archive app is still available at both app stores. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. There you can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, or hate mail, just a general statement or inquiry? You can email us at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out, and we will prevail, rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and a big thanks to Kiwi Station for putting us on and making us available 24/7, 365 around the world. This is Melvin signing off. And now that I've woken you up, good morning.